Well, thank you for that warm welcome. I think I'm probably in a group here that doesn't need ice cream to be induced to buy books. That seems to me you would buy them anyway. The books are your ice cream or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's I've had a great impression of Southern. I've really never been on campus. I've known about it for a long time. And have really enjoyed my time here so far. Got a campus tour today. Got to see the beautiful grounds that are here. Really impressed with that. Didn't get to see the famous Moeller Library, but maybe sometime I'll come back and get an opportunity to do that. But I have great regard for the Southern Baptists, especially in this day and age and culture when it just seems like the whole broader evangelical culture is just spinning apart. And the Baptists are striking me as very, very firm and maintaining that commitment. And I've always held the Southern Baptists in high regard and think of what we do at Moody Bible Institute as sort of Baptistic, like sort of in something of the same orbit, perhaps. But grew up in Memphis, so I had always heard of Adrian Rogers. Maybe that's a name you guys know, pastor from Bellevue Baptist Church. And I actually one time went on a tour with a group of Southern Baptist students, and it was even Paige and Dorothy Patterson, which I suspect you guys know them as well. And we toured around in Tunisia. We went into Algeria. It was like a Footsteps of Augustine tour. And so we actually went under armed escort from the army into the country of Algeria and were able to see Hippo. And one of my favorite memories is seeing the baptismal font that is, you know, it's ruins now, the basilica there in Hippo where Augustine ministered. And there's the baptismal font sort of next to it. And I actually got down in that with Dr. Paige Patterson and pretended to baptize him. So that's, you know, I figure he's probably already baptized and wouldn't be rebaptized, you know, theologically. But at least we reenacted it in Augustine's own spot. So that was a great delight, not to mention hearing Mrs. Dr. Dorothy Patterson talk about St. Monica in that setting. Just seemed like the perfect place to do that. So again, thank you for allowing me to come and speak to you. And the title of the paper is Roman Persecution of the Ancient Church. And if I were to subtitle it, I would say something like, did it happen? How do we know? Can we rely on ancient texts? And so that's what I want to really dig into is how we appropriate and think about martyrdom, looking back to the ancient times. How do we bring these texts forward? And so let me begin. I begin with a quote, a quotation. God, I want to surrender all my plans to you today. I want to give you the complete, utter control in my life. I want to lift you high above all else. If you are a Christian, you have probably prayed or sung words like these. Maybe you often whisper such things to God. The person who wrote these words has set forth a worthy goal. But what makes them all the more powerful is that soon afterward, their author took 3 bullets in the face from a 7mm pistol because she was proclaiming Jesus in a place that didn't want him. I remember attending chapel in November 2002. When it was announced that American missionary Bonnie Witherall had been gunned down by a Muslim extremist. I was a new professor at Moody Bible Institute, so I had never had Bonnie in class like some of my colleagues, but soon we all knew her story, how she had moved to Lebanon to minister among the poor, how she worked in a prenatal clinic providing health care to local Muslim women, how she and her husband Gary knew international tensions were high, yet could not turn back from the call of God on their lives. A few weeks after the shooting, Gary came to speak at Moody. He didn't possess the charisma of a televangelist or the rhetoric of an orator, but he didn't need to. His message of Bonnie's profound faithfulness to Jesus Christ brought a flood of students to the front of the chapel as they renewed their commitment to God. These are the words with which I began my book, Early Christian Martyr Stories, and they seem entirely fitting to commence tonight's remarks as well. We are gathered here for a conference about Christian persecution, and it is my task to examine that evil phenomenon as it was experienced by the ancient church. But as we carry out this task, it is absolutely critical to reflect on how we should access, retell, and deploy the martyr's story. Can we in fact, draw a direct line between early church persecution and our own experience today? Can we truly equate Bonnie Witherall and the figure of Wibia Perpetua, who died 1,800 years before Bonnie, for likewise professing the Christian faith? There are good reasons to compare the two. Both were young females. Both loved Jesus Christ. Both were relinquishing dreams of secure motherhood when they made dangerous life choices that could easily lead to violence. Perpetua is hailed today as a martyr, and Bonnie has been called one too, and I will not dispute that. Nevertheless, the reality is you cannot put a toga and sandals on Bonnie or jeans and a t-shirt on Perpetua and consider them essentially the same person. Both women have left us their personal diaries. And while there are points of contact between the two, even so, a wide gap separates each woman's spirituality. Things are vastly different today than they were in the Roman Empire. We must be careful about quick and easy comparisons. This cautionary word has recently been offered by Professor Candida Moss in her best-selling book, The Myth of Persecution: How Early Christians Invented a Story of Martyrdom. The book has many agendas, some of which I would embrace, others not so much. Many of its scholarly conclusions are helpful, though I find a few somewhat untenable, as I shall explore in a moment. For now, let me use Professor Moss's book to raise the issue of historical accuracy in hagiography. That is the main topic I wish to address tonight: historicity in hagiography. For example, in The Myth of Persecution, we are confronted with the figure of Cassie Bernal, one of the 13 victims of the shooting massacre at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Cassie's story is chronicled in a book by her mother called She Said Yes, The Unlikely Martyrdom of Cassie Bernal, in which this troubled teenager struggles to walk faithfully as a Christian. Yet when a murderous gunman asks Cassie if she believes in God, she replies yes and is killed. Though Cassie was immediately hailed as a martyr, Professor Moss notes that later investigations questioned whether these events actually took place, or perhaps got confused with another female student who was interrogated by the shooter about her religious beliefs. If we are going to revere Cassie Bernal as a martyr, Moss writes, we need to know if she was given the opportunity to be a martyr, if choice and a demonstrable belief in God are important for a person's definition of a martyr, then our inability to know exactly what the martyr said is critically important. Professor Moss is right. It is exactly why historicity in hagiography is so important. We want those to whom we give our highest respect to be worthy of such a claim. When it comes to martyrs, we need trustworthy facts. In light of all this, let me frame out what I hope to accomplish this evening. Perhaps the first thing I should address is what I do not intend to do. It is not my task to pass judgment on who can or cannot be called a martyr today, or whether any of us can claim to be part of the persecuted church. I certainly, and without reservation, wish to recognize that Christian persecution is an egregious tragedy happening all over the planet, even as we speak. Right now, evil murderers are claiming the lives of our brothers and sisters because they name the name of Jesus. I mean, we've got Voice of the Martyrs table over here, and I'm sure that there would be immediate support of what I just said. It's happening, right? So were I confronted with facts I knew to be accurate, I would have no problem calling many of these fellow Christians martyrs, including a figure like Bonnie Witherall. Yet, as I said, there are lots of reasons to be leery about direct comparisons to the early church. Each situation should be taken on a case-by-case basis, and the principle of historicity in hagiography applies to us today just as much as to the ancient world. That is to say, we shouldn't be too quick to assign the martyr label without some serious fact-checking, if for no other reason than out of respect for the high honor that such a label ought to command from us. And when it comes to Christians in modern, affluent America, we should be very careful about seeing ourselves as persecuted, especially when we haven't had to shed our blood or suffer bodily harm like many of our global brethren. That is why I am reluctant to use tonight's address to claim in any way that those gathered in this room would automatically be the inheritors of the ancient church's legacy of martyrdom. Only if there happen to be some people here today who have borne the cross of Jesus Christ in a special way, should we honor them as belonging to the persecuted church. So then, what do I propose to speak about? I hope to provide a broad overview of the 2,000-year reception of early Christian hagiography. Now, I have used that word a few times already, so perhaps I should stop and define it. Hagiography literally means writing about holy people. In other words, it was an attempt to document and celebrate the lives and deaths of godly individuals, typically to spur others to imitate them. Often, the holy people being celebrated in such texts are martyrs. The hagiographical literature of the ancient church is the primary, though not the only, means by which we learn about early Christian persecution. In the first part of my address, then, I propose to investigate why the ancient hagiographical literature developed and how it has traditionally been categorized by modern scholars until the late 20th century. In part two, I will take a look at some new trends in the recent scholarship on martyrdom. If I may introduce a term, I will call this the skeptical school, of which Candida Moss would be a leading advocate. By skeptical school, I mean a kind of methodological skepticism that tends to view ancient martyrdom texts as being later documents than they purport to be, thus often forgeries, as well as being highly rhetorical literary creations, meaning they argue for certain theological perspectives that have little grounding in actual facts. In other words, we are confronted with, to say it again, the issue of historicity. If Cassie Bernal's mother writes about her daughter based on personal experience, eyewitness testimony from inside Columbine High, or official police reports, that is one thing. But if somebody, a century from now, were to compose a brand new biography in which Cassie advocates views that people are debating about in the year 2100, we would have every reason to question it. This is what I appreciate about the skeptical school. A healthy dose of skepticism is a good thing if we want to honor actual martyrs rather than enjoy inspiring Christian fiction. Candida Moss is an exceptionally fine scholar, an expert with complete control of her sources and mastery of her field. I have profited from her work precisely because I do not have the ability to imitate it. And that is why I will have several commendations for the skeptical school. Yet I reserve the right to raise some cautions as well. In particular, I will suggest we ought not become so skeptical that we throw out the baby with the bathwater, rejecting the possibility of assigning historical validity to any of the ancient martyr texts. Pious legends do abound in this literature, but let's not let the pendulum of skepticism swing too far to the other side. We have every reason to think the early Christians experienced enough death, violence, mockery, and social ostracism that they would have often perceived themselves to be living in a climate of persecution. We ought not silence these ancient voices, nor suppose that they would not have tried to record their tragic communal experiences. Okay, so here's part one, and this would be the traditional views of hagiography. All right, let us turn our attention first to the traditional way of understanding ancient martyrdom texts. If we explore the earliest roots of Christian hagiography, we might recall a biblical text like Acts 6-7, which records the long speech of Stephen, then describes how this righteous man remains steadfast as he gazes upon Jesus, even while his persecutors stone him to death. Surely it was part of the writer Luke's desire to capture accurate historical information about such a holy man, holding up a real event in Stephen's life as an example for other believers, which shows that the word hagiography does not have to be equated only with falsified legends or pious fiction. From the beginning, the ancient Christians cared about what actually happened, though spiritual embellishments and imaginative reinterpretations were welcomed as well. This sort of historical slash hagiographical motivation continued for a long time in early Christian literature. So in the case of Polycarp, who died in 156 AD, the church in Smyrna wrote to a sister church located nearby, as well as to all the Catholic churches everywhere, saying, "Brothers, we're writing to give you an account of what happened to the martyrs, and especially to the blessed Polycarp, whose martyrdom brought an end to the persecution." Likewise, the editor of Perpetua's story remarks, "Illustrations of true faith are set down in writing so that God might be honored and people comforted by reading and recalling the very facts themselves." Clearly, in both cases, these editors had historical motives for composing their hagiographical texts. They wanted to record the facts. We often find this to be the case when it comes to the earliest writings. However, the first truly systematic Christian hagiographer, at least that we know of, was the 4th century bishop Eusebius of Caesarea. The Christian library at his home city of Caesarea on the coast of Palestine was unparalleled in the ancient world, rooted in Origen's personal collection of scholarly texts and expanded by Eusebius's erudite mentor Pamphilus. This library owned the best of whatever could be obtained at the time about the origins of the Christian faith. For that reason, the church history of Eusebius remains a vital text for early Christian studies, as Dr. Haken opened by reading a selection out of that text that preserved an ancient letter. So clearly it's a repository of important stuff. Yet, in our present context, we are drawn instead to another of Eusebius's writings, known as the Martyrs of Palestine, which in an abbreviated Greek version eventually got sandwiched between books 8 and 9 of the church history, and which has survived independently in its longer form only in a Syriac translation. Eusebius's remarks about the purpose of this writing illumine us as to the intent of his entire historical project. "Let us, therefore," he says, "commit to writing a commemoration not to be forgotten." He says, "As for those conflicts which were gloriously achieved in various other countries, it is right that they who were then living should describe what took place in their own country." And since Eusebius himself claims to have been living in Palestine during the time of these persecutions, he promises to describe the deeds of the martyrs for the common instruction and benefit of all. In other words, Eusebius understood his method to require accurate records of ancient martyrdom based on eyewitness or solid textual evidence, while at the same time he felt free to transmit this material via the hyperbolic language of spiritual edification. From Eusebius's time on, there emerged what can only be called a nuclear explosion of hagiography. It would be impossible this evening for me to do justice to the whole history of late antique and medieval Latin writings about the saints' lives, much less the Byzantine, Syriac, Armenian, Georgian, Arabic, Coptic, Ethiopic, or Celtic hagiography, which flourished from the Atlantic coast of Ireland to the Euphrates River and even across Central Asia as far as China. But in a nutshell, what happened is that the stories of the saints and martyrs entered into the consciousness of the Latin-speaking world through the help of Roman Catholic liturgical calendars called martyrologies, which listed the feast days assigned to each saint along with a brief entry about each one. All of this was supported by massive hagiographical underpinnings. Medieval life was suffused with numerous popular narratives and biographies, oral folklore, formal liturgies, poetry, the veneration of bones and relics at holy shrines, and religious art and architecture of every imaginable kind. Suffice it to say that in the Middle Ages, Saint Thecla was a household name, the way Taylor Swift is for us today. I don't know if Thecla sang, but she was definitely a popular female figure at the time. Or, to use a literary example, the explosive success of the Harry Potter series in recent times could be paralleled with the bestseller status of The Golden Legend, a work begun by the Italian Archbishop Jacobus de Voragine in 1260 and expanded greatly by subsequent imitators over the coming centuries. The golden legend survives today in around 1,000 Latin manuscripts, plus more than 500 vernacular translations, having been spread across the medieval European landscape by the newly mobile friars called the Dominicans. Such a popular text, full of thrilling martyr stories, tinged with sadistic voyeurism and eroticism, including 81 different forms of torture and death, was guaranteed to be a literary success. And inevitably, it would be disseminated even more widely once Gutenberg's printing press came on the scene around 1450. Now, instead of depending on elite priests to filter the golden legend through their sermons, everyone had direct access to the lives of the saints. The popularity of this sort of literature gave rise to the famous Acts and Monuments of These Latter and Perilous Days by John Fox, more commonly known as Fox's Book of Martyrs. This book has gone through many editions and abridgments since its author died in 1587. In fact, it has basically been in continuous publication ever since it was first released. Although Fox's book focuses on Protestant deaths in the 16th century, the significant development for our purposes here tonight is the way the author divided up church history. His 1570 edition of the Acts and Monuments identified the ancient period as the suffering time of the church, which containeth 300 years after Christ. This three-century period of suffering is subdivided into 10 distinct persecutions under various emperors, finally ending in the year 324, when Constantine gained sole power over the empire. After this comes phase two of church history, the flourishing and growing time, followed by phase three, the declining time of the church and of true religion. Then, when we hit the year 1324, after a millennium of peace, Satan is loosed once more. So this fits with what Dr. Schreiner said today about the multiple interpretations of Revelation. Well, here's one that was in Fox's Book of Martyrs. In 1324, after a millennium of peace, Satan is loosed, holding the church captive until the Protestant martyrs and proto-Protestant heroes like John Wycliffe can set it right again. So Fox's Book of Martyrs was an enormously influential book in the English-speaking world. As such, it cemented into the public consciousness many ideas about Christian martyrdom, including the notion that the pre-Constantinian era was a suffering time of the church. This way of thinking is, as we shall see, still very much with us today. I'm sure you've probably heard the idea of the period before Constantine being the period of persecution, and that's a very old way of thinking. So, with such a huge mess of hagiographical legends now being used not only for church liturgies or personal devotional reading, but even as ammunition in the Protestant-Catholic wars, how could anyone know the actual truths about the ancient martyrs? The problem we are addressing this evening, the lack of historicity in hagiography, might not have bothered the pious monks and devout clergy of the High Middle Ages during what has been called the Age of Faith, but it definitely became a problem for the rational thinkers of the Enlightenment, or what we call the Age of Reason, which began around 1650. It was precisely at this time that a massive new scholarly project was born, one that would come to be noted for its scientific rigor as opposed to deferential religious conformity. A Jesuit scholar from modern-day Belgium, John Bolland, caught the vision for producing a new critical edition of the hagiographical text pertaining to every saint in the church's liturgical calendar, from the apostles themselves to the newly minted saints of the medieval church. In 1643, the first volume of the Acta Sanctorum was published, launching the epic project that the Bollandist Society would, with some hiccups, continue in Brussels up to the present day. But the Bollandists immediately met resistance, for as they began to reveal the shaky foundations upon which most of the saints' lives rested, they ran afoul of many powerful stakeholders within the Catholic Church, men whose positions as well as personal piety were intertwined with the historicity of certain patron saints. Thus, the Bollandists came to represent historical accuracy while church authorities were in the awkward position of defending long-held traditions that no longer seemed able to bear the weight of modern scrutiny. Eventually, even the top authorities of the Roman Catholic Church were obliged to recognize the validity of this point. In the 1963 liturgical reforms of the Vatican II Council, it was decreed that the accounts of martyrdom or the lives of the saints are to accord with the facts of history. The man most responsible for giving the Acta Sanctorum the rigorous historical and philological emphasis it now has, and perhaps the most important member of the Bollandist Society after its original founder, was Hippolyte Dulouet, who lived from 1859 to 1941. Dulouet became known for treating the legends of the saints with scientific neutrality, just like any other historical documents. Thus, what began to emerge through the work of the Bollandists, especially during the great era of historical critical scholarship in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, events that were being paralleled in the field of biblical studies, was a new skepticism toward virtually all the legends of the saints. However, the key word here is virtually. In his 1921 book, The Passions of the Martyrs and Literary Genres, Dulouet made a fundamental distinction between historical passions, or texts which have a high degree of veracity, and all other kinds of hagiographical material, which are to be treated as far more dubious. Only very few texts can lay claim to being among the historically well-grounded ones. And yet, for the Bollandists, some reputable ones did exist, and these as early as the second century. Over the years, scholars have offered various lists of the authentic or reliable martyrdom accounts. Typically, this literature is divided into three main categories: acts, passions, and fictional legends of various genres. The legends are the legends that we're talking about are the clearly fabulous tales with abundant miracles and pious yet sexually vulnerable damsels like Saint Lucy, a virgin martyr of Diocletian's persecution. She was supposedly threatened with whipping, then sentenced to be raped to death by a crowd of lustful men. When God's power renders Lucy unable to be carried away, she is unfortunately drenched in urine, then boiling oil by her persecutor, but to no effect. A late tradition adds that her two eyes were gouged out. At last, although she is stabbed in the neck, she is still able to offer pious thoughts and receive the Holy Eucharist before she expires. The story of St. Agnes is similar, except in that case, the virginal saint, threatened with gang rape, miraculously grew long hair to cover her naked body. It is easy to see how these seemingly devout, yet slightly titillating stories would have gained a wide audience. And of course, it's not that Roman society never did this sort of thing, so that a real Lucy or an Agnes figure couldn't have existed. It's just that the textual basis for saying anything about them is so insecure that we are really in the realm of pious fiction, not historical inquiry. I'm stuffy. Is it stuffy in here, or is it just me? Is it? I saw some people fanning themselves. So sorry if I'm up here like an old country preacher. Should I have a Bible in my hand and be waving it around or whatever? But anyway, is the air running, Holly?
The air is currently
not. Okay. Okay, good. So just bear with me as I labor up here and swathed in wool or whatever I am. So, all right. I mentioned about, St. Agnes and her long hair that grows down over her body. Strange stories, of course. So some other texts are not like that. Scholars of early church martyrdom have typically considered a few of the early acts and passions to be of greater historical reliability than tall tales like these. The term acts, Latin acta, is used by scholars in two different ways in this context. It can sometimes refer to texts that speak about the mighty deeds of their protagonists, deeds that were accomplished during their lifetimes, even though a martyrdom story sometimes concludes the account. It is in this sense that we would also speak of the biblical Acts of the Apostles, a work that, if you think about it, is almost exclusively about the apostles' lifetime activities, not their deaths. But in the specifically martyrological context, the word acta, or acts, refers to texts that are not biographical at all. Instead, we basically have a courtroom transcript with no backstory whatsoever. The martyrs make their first appearance at the end of their lives as they stand trial before the judge. We don't get a sense of their inner feelings, just a he said, she said public dialogue, the back and forth exchange between the prosecutor and the accused that the court stenographer recorded and put on file. When the sentence is finally passed on the condemned martyrs, we learn nothing about their actual deaths, other than that they did, in fact, occur. In other words, we are being given the essential facts of the martyr's trial and execution based on an official legal record with a minimum of spiritualizing. The Acts of Justin, the Acts of the Solitan Martyrs are texts of this type. In contrast to this are the Passions, such as the story, a very famous one, the story of Perpetua and Felicity. In the Passion genre, we learn quite a bit about the martyr's background and the circumstances that brought them to the arrest and trial. Even if a courtroom scene forms part of the narrative, we do not feel that we are reading a stenographer's report. Though the courtroom dialogue may have been culled from such a text, it is set within a narrative arc that is moving toward a climactic resolution. The author has a definite theological agenda that he is expressing through his vivid description of key events. In Passion stories, we definitely hear about the martyrs' sufferings during their imprisonment and execution, for that is what the word passio means. It is a text about suffering and how the holy champions triumphed over it. Therefore, these are more fully developed texts than the bare bones acts. Now, by the time the Bollandists had done all of their investigative sorting of the acts, the passions, and the legends, very few of the thousands of saints and martyrs that church history has bequeathed to us were able to withstand historical scrutiny. As Candida Moss amusingly puts it, if the saints are supposed to participate in a heavenly banquet, what was once a crowded buffet now resembles an intimate dinner party. Nevertheless, modern scholars, until recent times, have agreed that there are a few historically reliable acts and passions prior to the persecution of Emperor Decius in 250. The number of these is about six, namely the martyrdom stories of 1. Polycarp, 2. Justin Martyr, 3. Ptolemy and Lucius, 4. the martyrs of Lyon and Vienne that Dr. Haken quoted from, 5. the Solitan Martyrs, and 6. Perpetua and Felicity. In addition to these, we do have a number of 2nd and early 3rd century texts about martyrdom, though they do not specifically describe a martyr's death, such as Ignatius of Antioch's letter to the Romans that we looked at last night in the panel discussion, Tertullian, Origen, others have treatises about a theology of martyrdom. There are also a number of martyr texts which circulated in very early times, but which are more legendary, namely the apocryphal Acts, that I argued last night ought to be given greater prominence in this discussion. So in sum, there are 5 or 6 authentic pre-Decian, that is prior to the time of Decius, accounts, plus a whole lot of supporting literature about martyrdom from the 2nd and early 3rd centuries. Now, the figure of Emperor Decius, who ruled at the midway point of the 3rd century, looms large in this discussion of early Christian martyrdom, often serving as a kind of historical dividing line. This raises the issue of periodization, or the successive phases that historians assign to different eras of the ancient church's experience of persecution. Typically, it would run something like this. The first phase is a disorganized and sporadic one, with no overarching legal policy governing how the Romans would deal with Christianity. Martyrs like Peter, Paul, maybe Ignatius of Antioch were killed under this type of haphazard scenario. But a little after 110 AD, an exchange of letters between the provincial governor, Pliny the Younger, and Emperor Trajan initiated a second phase, Due to Trajan's imperial rescript, back to Pliny, it became known in judicial circles that Christianity was something which ought to be prosecuted if it ever started causing problems. Though in practice this did not happen very often, the local political machine in each province was now empowered to put Christians to death simply for adhering to this faith, if it seemed in the state's best interest to do so. This policy of Christianity being under state ban, yet not being actively sought out, would prevail for the next 140 years. Thus, the martyrs of the second or early third centuries were killed, not at the emperor's direct command, but whenever a local official decided he had good enough reason to enforce this standing legal precedent against the Christian faith. And that brings us to the time of Decius in 250. Now, as I said, this year is typically considered a dividing line that marked the beginning of a third phase, the phase of active imperial persecution. At this time, it became official policy that everyone must appear before specially appointed commissioners and make a declaration of devotion to the pagan gods through ritual actions. Only then would you be issued a libellus, a certificate that proved your loyalty and exempted you from prosecution. Those who refused to worship the gods would be executed. Recent scholarship has called attention to the fact that Decius nowhere states he's out to get Christians in particular. What he really wanted was religious uniformity to serve as a kind of glue to hold his fractured empire together. The mid-third century was a time of crisis, and he was looking for a way to sort of put the pieces back together. In other words, he hoped loyalty to the official deities of the state cult would unite his realm. But despite this silence about Christianity, a fair read of the evidence has inclined many historians to consider this policy a de facto attack against the church. Decius's decree was inevitably going to catch Christians in its nets when they refused to bow to the demonic gods, and that is exactly what happened. The Christian church and the Jews were by far the two most visible groups that would have repudiated Greco-Roman polytheism. But unlike the Jews, the Christians were given no special reprieve. Many historians believe Decius even presided over the execution of the Roman bishop Fabian as the first casualty of the new legislation. If you ever go to Rome, you visit the catacombs, the Callistus catacombs, for example, you can see the burial plaque of written there in Greek of Bishop Fabian, who was killed in the time of Decius, and he was buried in the catacombs. In fairness, then, it is hard not to interpret this policy as a move that was going to be especially, indeed, intentionally lethal for Christians. For that reason, it is known as the Decian persecution, even if it was technically a neutral imperial offensive against all non-pagan religious practice. Fortunately for the church, the Decian persecution was over rather quickly. After a brief respite, the emperor Valerian renewed persecution for a time, and he explicitly targeted Christian leaders, which I think no doubt throws some light on Decius's intentions as well. But once the decade of the 250s ended, the church entered a 40-year phase that has come to be called the Little Peace of the Church. In the year 260, Emperor Gallienus declared Christians exempt from state prosecution. In fact, for the first time in history, they were even granted formal recognition, which meant they had certain legal privileges, such as the right to assemble and own property. And so you begin to see a church building program start to take form at that time, when they could own property. Everyone breathed a sigh of relief. The age of persecution appeared to have passed, but it was not to be. The final phase of ancient Christian persecution began in the year 303. Because of its ferocity, it has come to be called the Great Persecution of Emperor Diocletian. The Christian religion was slated for termination, literally for termination. It was the work was begun on the festival of the god Terminus, to show that we are now terminating and eliminating all Christians through a series of increasingly severe decrees. However, the actual infliction of judicial violence varied greatly across the empire. This was due to the complex politics of the time, in which power had been divided among the participants in an imperial college known as the Tetrarchy. Some of these figures were more zealous than others about enforcing Diocletian's edicts. In Britain, for example, this was under Constantine's father, persecution was limited to a few church demolitions, whereas in Asia Minor and the Levant, the blood ran deep. Over the course of the next decade, persecution gradually petered out in most of the provinces, yet in some places it continued unabated, or at least loomed as a possibility if the political winds were to sweep someone with a more violent policy into power. Only with Constantine's defeat of Maxentius at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in 312 did the great persecution truly come to an end. This was not because Maxentius or anyone in the Roman West was still persecuting. The battle was pivotal not for what it actually changed, but what it cemented into place. Constantine was a staunch supporter of the church, so when he gained sole rule of the West and sole rule of the whole empire shortly thereafter, absolute power came to rest in the hands of a monarch who was steadfastly opposed to a policy of persecution. Eventually, though how quickly it happened is debated, Emperor Constantine even came to see himself as a personal follower of Jesus Christ. Now, I don't know if we'll see Constantine in heaven or not. You know, that's maybe hard to know. But at least by the end of his life, late in his life, he's very much saying, I'm a Christian and paganism is no good. So his famous Edict of Milan in 313 did not so much bring existing persecution to an end as eliminate its future possibility forever, at least within the boundaries of the Roman Empire. It should be noted that Constantine accidentally triggered terrible martyrdoms in the Persian Empire by showing support for Christians in that realm, but that story is outside the scope of tonight's address. The main point is that in traditional historiography, Constantine represents the end of bloodshed against Roman Christians, and in this way, he brought to an end the age of persecution experienced by the early church. So that's the first part, and what I was summarizing is the way that scholars have periodized and understood early church martyrdoms. Now I want to turn to part two and the so-called skeptical school, and we'll be a little more brief there, but let's talk about some of the latest developments in the scholarship of martyrdom. So, as I said at the outset, more recent scholarship has questioned the traditional way of thinking. The extent of Christian martyrdom is said to be far less than is normally believed. It cannot be denied, of course, that under Diocletian, Christians experienced brutal persecution. Likewise, Emperor Decius, while not explicitly targeting Christians as far as we know, nonetheless initiated harsh policies that had bloody repercussions for the ancient church. So, some widespread killing of Christians clearly did occur in the Roman Empire for a few years, between 250 and 312 AD. The skeptical school, as I'm calling it, does not deny that such judicial bloodshed occurred. Rather, the new approach tends to minimize it. We simply do not have, say these historians, a continuous string of martyr saints from Peter's crucifixion on the right bank of the Tiber until 2.5 centuries later, Constantine won his cross-inspired victory a short ways upstream from where the Prince of the Apostles had breathed his last. Historians of ancient Christianity are not confronted with a supposed age of persecution, but, say the skeptical school, but with a few scattered criminals prosecuted under ordinary Roman law for crimes like illegal assembly or disturbing the peace. This happened very rarely, and even when it did, we really can't know much about it. So you can see what's being said here is in some ways there's a removal of the concept of persecution of the ancient church. How does the skeptical school go about making its case? Basically, it continues the work of the Bollandists by raising questions about the received corpus of martyr stories. Yet, if the Bollandists were known for insisting on historicity and hagiography. And in this way, they reduced the number of credible martyr stories by, let's say, 99%. The present-day skeptical school attempts to finish the job and snuff out even the lone remaining percentage point. The six traditionally reliable pre-Decian martyr stories are being dismantled one by one, exposed as pious frauds from a later age. How? The argument is usually made that, one, these texts have a clear theological agenda and so are suspicious on their face as works of propaganda, and two, they contain certain elements that are said to reflect the views of a later era, perspectives which could not have existed, even in incipient form, at the time the documents purport to have been written. Therefore, the earliest martyr stories, since they are literary forgeries from many decades after the original eyewitnesses passed off the scene, cannot contain any accurate historical information. We have no way of knowing anything about those mysterious people who died for activities related to their Christian beliefs. Now, what are we to think about this new skeptical school? On the one hand, Dr. Candida Moss and others who espouse this view are to be commended for bringing professional historical rigor to these highly legendary texts. Protestants, in particular, have always been suspicious of the great panoply of saints that had overtaken the Roman Church by the late Middle Ages, creating a dense crowd of intermediaries between the average Christian and their glorious Lord. That is why the Bollandists' work of revealing the bogus nature of these saintly legends was welcomed by the Protestants. Those of us who have no interest in assigning the noble title of martyr to some mythological personage concocted out of late antique or medieval piety can applaud the historical critical method advocated by contemporary scholars of Christian hagiography. This method will also do much to correct the kind of Sunday school mentality that glamorizes the ancient church as an era of continuous bloodshed, as if the cry, "The Christians to the lions," rang out every Sunday, and faithful believers huddled in dark catacombs while a grim Roman soldier with a red brush on his helmet awaited his quarry on the surface. The, quote, underground church of ancient times never existed like this, and we have no business propagating such a mythology. Furthermore, let me go on to say that the critical method of this skeptical school is welcome not just when applied to St. Agnes's magic hair and other ridiculous legends, but even when applied to the handful of pre-Decian texts that have normally been considered historical. If we were to lose even the last 1% of authentic early martyr stories, so be it. The new approach has also done much to reveal that these texts were not neutral, objective histories, but were attempts to convey theological history from a definite point of view. To create the martyr figure as he or she classically appears in these texts is to say something very specific about one's own community, as well as about the enemy upon whom divine judgment rests. The martyr acts, like virtually all ancient texts, have a reception history that includes subsequent redactions and possible later interpolations. Where these edits can be discovered, they help us peel back the later accretions to get to the actual historical figure at the heart of the narrative. Of course, what I just said assumes that there is indeed a historical personage retrievable in these stories. I believe there sometimes is. And thus, I'm revealing my cards as a critic, as well as a supporter, of the skeptical school. To me, this approach too often suffers from an overly skeptical method that arrives at implausible conclusions about the earliest texts. Can we really conclude that because the martyr stories were advancing an agenda, they must be treated as outright fabrications? If we were to apply this method to other important texts of classical antiquity, we would be able to say virtually nothing about any ancient figures. The task of the classical historian would come to a screeching halt. But do we really need to reduce our historical assertions to zero? I do not think so. Having an agenda, and even making up some details to support that agenda, does not invalidate every single thing that an ancient writer may have said about his subject. Tacitus, for example, had the agenda of discrediting Emperor Domitian, but that does not mean everything he recorded about the man is vapor and mist. The historian's job is to sift, retaining what makes sense in context and recognizing what is out of place. The skeptical school uses a sieve with very wide holes, a sieve that filters away all the evidence, leaving us only staring at an empty mesh. Whereas my sieve would have a tighter weave so that many factual nuggets would remain even after we have applied the sifting tools of critical scholarship. What this means is that we are really talking about the kind of historiography we wish to bring to the table. A negative, skeptical historiography is one way of looking at things, whereas my approach would be more positive about what we can say, though without, I hope, being gullible or credulous with regard to the sources. And the main way to make some valid historical assertions without being taken in by the text's agenda is to corroborate the text in question by some reference point known to exist outside of it. That is precisely what I think we can do with the six authentic pre-Decian martyr acts, rendering them far more reliable than the skeptical school claims them to be. It is impossible, of course, in the time we have left tonight, to make a case-by-case argument for the authenticity of each of these documents. But let us take a moment to glance at the one text considered the most important, because it is ostensibly the earliest, the Martyrdom of Polycarp. This is the text Candida Moss first criticized in a deconstructing journal article in 2010, and it forms a major part of her subsequent books, including The Myth of Persecution, which gained such wide notice when it was published in 2013. The central thesis here is that while the document appears to have been written immediately after the death of Bishop Polycarp of Smyrna in 156 AD, certain textual clues indicate it actually comes from a century later, around the time of Emperor Decius. Perhaps with hyperbole, or perhaps with intentional skepticism, Moss concludes, the earliest, listen to this quote, the earliest martyrdom account, the document that scholars believe began and fed interest in martyrdom, is a pious fraud. It pretends to be by eyewitnesses, but in fact it was not. At this point, we have to ask ourselves, what can we trust about Polycarp himself? We don't really know anything about the circumstances of his arrest, trial, and death. This makes it impossible to know the reason he was executed or the principles he died for. If all we can know is the fact of his execution, then we have to face the possibility that the martyr we admire is the invention of the author. He is a pious, appreciative, and earnest invention, but an invention nonetheless. Now, I find that statement to be remarkable in its sort of utter repudiation of an entire text full of specific details and saying, no, I declare in 2010, or today, that none of those details can be valid. It's remarkable. And I would note as well that not all scholars would apply such extreme hermeneutics of suspicion to this text. No less a historian than Timothy Barnes, a man no one could accuse of being credulous when it comes to handling ancient sources, came out unequivocally on the side of an early date for Polycarp in a major work on hagiography from 2010, which was the same year Moss was redating the martyrdom to a century afterward. Likewise, my friend Paul Hartog, in his authoritative 2013 critical edition of Polycarp from Oxford Press, declares that he tentatively opts for an enhanced composition in the third quarter of the second century. In other words, he dates the text within 20 years of Polycarp's death and relying on eyewitness traditions. So I myself would concur with these more conservatively optimistic assessments of scholars like these, saying that we have here an early text with factual content, even if it comes wrapped, as it clearly does, wrapped in literary adornments. Now, there's a little bit more I could have said. I'm not going to go through it. I'll summarize it briefly by saying that one point, for example, is that at the end of the Martyrdom of Polycarp, it talks about the fact that they wanted to bury his bones in a reliable place. And much is made of that as being a third century argument, but I think you can corroborate through burial practices of the Christians and of Jews well in the second century that that's a perfectly good explanation of that text. So let me conclude as two paragraphs, we're done. Maybe a little Q&A. So there's much more evidence that I could have offered. This is not the place to hash out the dating of Polycarp's martyrdom. My ultimate point, my takeaway, is that when it comes to historicity and hagiography, we are right to be skeptical of much that has come down to us. The legends of the martyrs are filled with lore that has no grounding in actual fact. Yet, enough nuggets of truth remain from the early church to reconstruct the second century mindset about martyrdom, and even the first century outlook, if we care to see it as the inception of a long-lasting trajectory. We are not, then, reduced to zero when it comes to hagiographical texts that bear the marks of authenticity. A few historical acts and passions, corroborated by other contemporaneous texts, as well as by archaeology, provide us with a thick description of the ancient church's experience of martyrdom. Therefore, I would like to suggest we truly can speak of the first three centuries of the church as an age of persecution, not in the sense of a continuous and unabated bloodshed, nor in the sense that everyone had exactly the same views about it, but at least in the sense of the martyr being a prominent and widely elevated hero who personified the early Christians' collective feelings of cultural alienation. We do have the necessary texts to prove this. They are decently reliable. Interpolated or polemical though they might be, if we apply a cautious historiography that is not needlessly skeptical, we can still hear the voices of an ancient people who, in the Apostle Paul's words, were carrying around in their bodies the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed. Thank you. Thank you.